and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention? Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by the Dispatch and Dispatch Media. It's Friday. It's Friday morning. I'm starting a little later than I normally would because things have been kind of hectic and weird around here. And the weather is finally, it's not fallish yet, but it's kind of fallish adjacent, which makes me happy because I do not like the heat. And I got particularly annoyed the last few days because it was gray and occasionally intermittently rainy, but still sort of hot and muggy, which is just seems unfair to me. Excuse me. I know people don't like to hear me sip coffee, and it was just very hot. So, what to talk about? I kind of feel like I haven't had a clean hit on this Biden MAGA Republicans thing. I know we talked about it a little bit on the drive time thing last week, but we just sort of touched on it. Some of the comments from people are that that I guess got a little too hung up on the partisan elements of it. And I think that just completely misses the point. Yeah, obviously, partisanship plays in all the time to partisan politics. But it seems to me like if you're going to, it's sort of like the supporting of MAGA Republican candidates, or for want of a better term, because I think MAGA Republican is already becoming a term that is getting away from each other, away from everybody. It's sort of like that, how the Democrats are supporting election deniers. Whatever I think of the election deniers, and I think people know what I think of the election deniers, but that doesn't matter. If you're saying that, if you're like making the T symbol and saying time out, this is different. This isn't about partisan politics. This isn't about, you know, the next election. This is about the future of the country. And these people are a profound existential threat to all we hold dear and to democracy itself. You just really shouldn't be helping them get nominated. You should be doing everything you can to sort of pelt them from the public stage, you know, short of violence and all that kind of thing. But you should be doing everything you can to delegitimize those sorts of people because you're the one who is saying that you believe it's for the good of the country. I have the exact same attitude among Republicans. I think the Republican Party, if it had any balls, if it had any moral seriousness and any gravity whatsoever, it would just say, you know, look, I understand you might win the primary, but we don't give a rat's ass. You can't run in this party. You can't, you know, if David Duke wants to run as a Republican, the Republican Party should be able to say no. And this is gets at the heart of my contempt for what the primary system has done to American politics. Some questions just shouldn't be put up to a vote. And I'm not talking about public policy stuff, right? I'm not talking about government. The parties are private institutions. You know, I don't know where everybody who listens to this podcast works, but my gut tells me that most of you work for businesses, whether they're for-profit or non-profit or whatever, organizations of one sort or another, where you do not put your hiring candidates, your policies, up to a vote to the broader public or even a narrow slice of the public. The way democracy enters the private sphere outside of government is when people vote with their wallets about what they want to buy. And that's a binary choice for consumers, is they can either spend their money on something or not spend their money on something. They don't get to say, you know, here's how you should run your company. I mean, they can do that through boycotts and stuff, but that's really inefficient. My point is that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are under no obligation to do anything that the party itself doesn't think is in its interests or the interests of the country. And this was like, this now sounds weird to people when you explain that, you know, this is the way parties work for like a century and a half. And it's the way most parties in most democracies work, where the party either, you know, through elections of all of the actual members of the party, I mean, like real members of the party, you know, sort of like a convention kind of thing, or through some smoke-filled room or some executive committee or some council or some, you know, one layer or another of decision-making bodies, they decide who their candidates are going to be and who they're not going to be. They don't just say, you know, welcome every Tom, Dick, and Harry, come vote on who should run our organization. And so I personally think the Republican Party, you know, should just say QAnon people can't be Republicans, just flatly. And I don't care if they could win primaries. They should change the rules so that that doesn't matter. And so I don't have a double standard here. But my point is that if you're a Democrat and you're saying these people are a fundamental threat, that they are semi-fascists or they're Nazis or they are holding a dagger at the heart of democracy itself, saying, well, but, you know, we should help them get nominated because for the Republican Party, because that'll make them marginally easier to beat, is just grotesque and cynical. And it's different than when they did it in 2012. It's different when, you know, it's different than other eras. If you actually want to be taken seriously, that you are legitimately concerned about the health and viability of democracy itself in America. And that, I'm sorry, that was a long tangent, but that's why my problem with the Biden thing is you got to keep the chocolate and the peanut butter separate. You cannot say you're talking about the soul of the nation. You're talking about how you're not demonizing anybody. You're talking about how, you don't mean all Republicans. You just mean this handful of sliver of people who are opposed to democracy and yada, yada, yada. And then lose the plot and lose message discipline and have some 25-year-old jackass running the president's Twitter feed start putting stuff up that makes it sound perfectly plausibly that you just mean Republicans. You know, the other day, the Biden Twitter account said, and I know I try to stay away from Twitter on this podcast as per the request of my loyal listeners, but this is the president's account, right? So this reflects an actual messaging strategy. And he has said stuff, and the White House has said stuff along these lines as well. But, you know, he had this tweet the other day, this, which is an official presidential statement, saying, you know, MAGA Republicans, I don't have it in front of me, but this is pretty dead on accurate, I'm pretty sure. MAGA Republicans don't understand what Democrats understand, that billionaires didn't build this country. The working class or the working people did. Something like that. Now, I think that's a dumb talking point, but that's fine. It's perfectly fair game in normal partisan politics. The problem is that is a normal partisan shot. And in fact, it's one they used against Mitt Romney, which I probably wrote 15 columns on that whole, you didn't build this thing. And the problem is that if your case is that you're using this term specifically and carefully and deliberately and with all due consideration for the higher principles of your office, you're using the phrase MAGA Republicans to talk about a specific threat that justifies the kind of rhetoric and the kind of arguments that you're making and the kind of claims that you're making, and saying that these are different, right? That these are really a domestic enemy in effect. And then you start getting all loosey-goosey and saying that, oh, and by the way, they believe the kind of stuff that Mitt Romney believed, or they're as guilty of the same sort of mistakes or bad philosophy as Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. You've done enormous damage to your own argument, right? And you've I think it's cynical. I try really hard, because I had to do this for years with Republicans, where people every time I ever did TV or debates or any of that kind of stuff with liberals, they always wanted to start from the argument that Republicans were deliberately evil in whatever controversy of the day. You know, when Trent Lott said that America would have been better off if Strom Thurmond had won the presidency, whatever. I remember Josh Marshall and Peter Beinart and all these guys that I would occasionally do CNN with or do other things. You know, they immediately assumed it was just a flat out racist dog whistle and outrageous and all that kind of stuff. And I get the argument. But, you know, my fallback go-to argument was that it was just incredibly stupid what he was saying. It was Trent Lott trying to flatter a gazillion-year-old dude, and said stuff that probably would have been fine at the Lions Club roast of Strom Thurmond and Mobile or whatever, but probably was less appropriate when there were television cameras there. I don't think Trent Lott intended to say something about how, it was a shame the Dixiecrats didn't start running the country in 1948 or anything like that. And so I try hard, because I've had to question a lot of my practices over my career in the last 7 years. And so I try hard to give the same benefit of the doubt to Democrats when they do stuff that it's stupid rather than cynical or villainous. And I'm struggling with this because I think Biden's a little confused about all this stuff. He doesn't know how to talk about this stuff well. He's been all over the map about it. But I certainly think that like Ron Klain and those guys know exactly what they're doing. I think it's a deeply cynical and pretty pernicious strategy that is that may in fact turn out to be smart and shrewd, as I wrote last week in the G-File. Or it may not. I personally think that the old, whether you invoke Sun Tzu or James Carville adage that when your enemy is destroying himself, don't get in the way. It's not obvious to me that letting Trump have the limelight without sort of intruding on it and saying we hate this guy is the best course of action. But it might be. It might be because they're looking at very granular numbers about how to activate certain parts of their coalition that don't normally turn out in midterm elections. And they may see something in the data that makes it worthwhile. So I can't tell you whether it's smart or dumb in terms of political strategy, partisan strategy. I do think it's certainly dumb if you actually take seriously the idea that Trump and the so-called MAGA Republicans represent a different threat to democracy than normal, run-of-the-mill Republicans that you disagree with. If you believe your own rhetoric about this stuff, then what they're doing is stupid as a matter of statesmanship. And even if it's, tactically shrewd as a matter of partisanship. Anyway, I think we covered that. What else is going on? Let's start with another thing that begins with B. The border buses being brought by Abbott. Okay, there's an A in front of Abbott. So, it's kind of hit a crescendo in the last few days or weeks or whatever. What Abbott's doing, as everybody probably knows, certainly if you've watched 5 minutes of Fox, you know this. Texas is sending busloads of undocumented migrants. I don't know what is the term that we're supposed to be allowed to say today. I have no problem with illegal immigrant. And I've always found the sort of tortured, no person is illegal kind of effort to turn it into like an offensive identity politics thing to be other garbage. But in the case that there are people out there who take offense at the phrase illegal immigrant, I don't mean it offensively. I just mean it as a legal status, as a descriptor of a certain group of people who came into this country without permission. So, you know, there you have it. Regardless, he's sending buses full of illegal immigrants to Chicago, Washington, D.C., where I live, and New York. I don't know if he's sending to L.A. or any of those other places. And I've been torn about this. I haven't written or talked much about it because I think it's a stunt. I think it's obviously pretty trolly and boob baity. I think Abbott is a real panderer on a lot of these kinds of issues. At the same time, I've wanted to come up with a good argument for why it's outrageous on the merits. And I can't really come up with one. Again, I haven't studied it, but my understanding is that all of these people are being sent with their consent, to these places. And, you know, I was supposed to talk on CNN the other day, but we didn't get to it. You know, it was supposed to be this like blockbuster revelation that Texas has spent, I think it was $15 million sending these buses to these places, as if like this is an outrageous use of Texas taxpayer dollars. And I don't know, maybe voters are wildly against it. I haven't seen that. But again, as just sort of a straightforward policy response, I kind of feel like I have to like support it or at least not condemn it. If there was something inhumane about it, if they were separating families and putting kids on one bus and parents on another, if those things are happening and I've missed it, I apologize and I will revise my opinion. But from what I've seen, they're basically just asking people, you know, do you want to go to Chicago? You want a free bus ticket to Chicago? And they send them to Chicago. And the thing is like, if we are in fact, as Joe Biden loves to say, and Barack Obama loved to say, and Democrats love to say, we are in fact the United States of America, right? There's this whole emphasis on united, that we are one country. One country politics was supposed to be the big thing for the Clinton administration. Lots of liberals believe in it because they kind of don't like federalism. They like this idea of, you know, of a unitary nation state, which is funny given how much they, in other contexts, they hate nationalism. I'll tell you, if there's one idea that is essential to any serious concept of nationalism, it is a unitary nation state. But regardless, you know, they love to make fun of people who talk about secession. They love to make fun of Republicans who complain about illegal immigration. They love to preen and virtue signal about how they have these sanctuary cities, which is what Chicago is and what I believe DC is, pretty sure New York is. They want to talk about the inhumanity of actually policing the border and that we should all be welcoming. And, you know, and then the mayor here in DC is asking for the National Guard to deal with a couple buses full of, you know, illegal immigrants. You know, a couple buses, Texas is being inundated with, I don't know how many buses worth of illegal immigrants every single day. And somehow, when we're all supposed to be, you know, neighborly and our brother's keeper and share burdens and rally around important moral causes, the people who have been preening about, you know, how they won't, you know, deal with, you know, with ICE, and how they won't ask people for their papers, and that everybody should be welcome, and that, you know, this is a sanctuary city, yada yada. They're furious, and they're calling, you know, like what's her face? I can't remember her name. The mayor of Chicago, is it Lightfoot? Anyway, you know, she's calling Abbott a monster for all of this. You know, like this soulless, cruel monster, and I don't get it. I don't get it as a serious argument. Yes, would it be better if the Biden administration sent buses to distribute these people? Yes, that would actually be better. Or would it be better if the Biden administration spent more money on border security and detention centers, humane detention centers? Yeah, that would be better too. But why? It's kind of a perversion, it's kind of perverse to say that Texas and Arizona are heartless, cruel, and whiny about the border crisis or illegal immigration, whether you think it's a crisis or not. You know, it's kind of perverse to demonize them as evil and uncompassionate, and then say, but then say, don't you dare send any of these poor, hungry people to my sanctuary city. And, you know, like I rail a lot about how I think we follow politics as a form of entertainment too much. And so I'm not advocating that we do that all the time. But sometimes it's a useful heuristic, right? I've written about this a bunch of times. Sometimes it's useful to sort of take the actual facts and think about how you could put them in a movie, and how difficult it would be or how easy it would be to make, you know, the various combatants villains or heroes. And I think about this sometimes, you know, about Israel. You know, if you actually show... you know, the terrorists going into playgrounds or into pizza parlors and blowing up high school kids, going onto buses and shooting up commuters or stabbing commuters and that kind of stuff. You could still very easily make a movie that is sympathetic to the plight of everyday Palestinians. I just don't know that you could make a movie that cast the people in charge of the organizations that sent those murderers to go do that killing as in any way heroic or honorable. Similarly, like if you just did a straightforward political drama where you had all of, you know, you had like Adams and this woman in Chicago and the mayor of DC and whoever else going in front of cameras and shedding crocodile tears about the plight at the border and about how, unlike those heartless people in Texas and Arizona, we are a sanctuary city. All are welcome. No one is illegal, blah, 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 blah. And then 5 minutes after one of these speeches, the next scene is them sitting in their office talking to their advisor saying, are you kidding me? There's no way we want these buses full of immigrants coming here. Turn them around. Get Biden to stop it. Get Abbott to stop it. This is outrageous, right? The hypocrisy of it is really kind of astounding when you think about it. And as a matter of pure public policy, right? I just think about it in terms of public policy. If Texas can't handle all, you know, we're constantly being told that these people aren't criminals. I think most of them are not. I'm pretty sympathetic about immigration stuff, but we're constantly told they're not criminals, they're refugees. Well, if they're refugees and Texas can't handle anymore because they're overwhelmed in their hospitals and everywhere else, why is it a cruel or bad public policy to send them to rich liberal cities with ample social services? I mean, I haven't heard the argument. So yeah, I don't like the trollishness and the performativeness of it. But intellectual honesty kind of compels me to say, I still think Abbott has the better of the argument on this. And, I wish our politics were different, that, you know, you didn't have, this kind of constant, you know, sniping between different states, but I'm curious to hear if someone has a good argument about why, I'm wrong about this or if I'm missing something, because I just don't know what it is. And again, I'm not trying to make by no means an apologist for Abbott. And I'm sure there are some problems at the margins with what Abbott is doing. But on broad brushstrokes, you know, if this had the imprimatur of the Biden administration, I think a lot of Democrats would support it. Right. I mean, I thought the whole complaint about Democrats is that they wanted, you know, as many illegal, they wanted as many illegal immigrants in the country as they can get. I mean, that's certainly the Republican charge, and that's certainly the way a lot of Democrats sound. So why wouldn't Biden say, hey, we're going to send a lot of buses to Texas, and we're going to get these refugees to places where they can be properly taken care of and have access to social services, and and we'll figure out their citizenship later. I, you know, the fact that Abbott is doing what is in effect a liberal policy, in order to highlight liberal hypocrisy, doesn't change the underlying facts on the ground. All right. Anyway. Yesterday, I got the Schadenfreude or the frisson of comeuppance to see Steve Bannon in handcuffs. And, I just want to be really clear. I think Bannon deserves to be in handcuffs. I think that if you think that Bannon has been mistreated by the system, if you think that Bannon is a victim, you're a dupe, or you've been duped. You may be brilliant in all sorts of other aspects of your life. I'm not saying you're a bad person or anything like that, but man, you've just been hoodwinked. Bannon's a grifter and a con man. And the only reason he wasn't put in handcuffs a couple years ago is because Trump nakedly pardoned him for cronyistic reasons. There was no like proper process for him applying for a pardon. There was no admission of guilt. He just basically, or I guess it was clemency, whatever, it doesn't matter. He basically said, this political crony of mine has carried water for me. And so the fact that he ripped off his biggest fans, the tune of millions in a fraud case, doesn't matter. He gets a pardon or clemency, whatever it was. I should also say that I think he should be in handcuffs for what he was involved in for January 6th. But, you know, that's got to be proved. And this thing's got to be proved. The reason why I'm confident that he belongs in handcuffs is I'm pretty sure like two of his partners have already pled guilty to this fraud scheme. It's a pretty transparent fraud scheme. And it is totally with predictable and within Bannon's normal approach to life to have ripped off the people who actually think he's not full of shit. And so I think he deserves to go to jail. People who think he's a martyr to the regime or the deep state are just making fools of themselves. And I'm done condescending to people by saying, oh, you make a good point, when they're like super fans of someone like Steve Bannon or Mike Lindell or Michael Flynn or any of these people. You're either in on the con or you're the mark, if you really believe any of the nonsense that these people or Sidney Powell have to say about anything having anything to do with politics, certainly anything having to do with their victimhood. And but that said, I think Andy McCarthy makes a very good point. And again, intellectual honesty requires me to admit it, because as much as I think Steve Bannon deserves to go to jail, and I think in a healthier time, he would have gone to jail for a lot of other things. It's pretty obvious that this prosecution in New York is political. You know, it was like in New York, it's a good political move to go after Steve Bannon because, you know, Steve Bannon is a dashboard saint of the crazy MAGA right and all of that. And I think Andy's right. It's like if Steve Bannon were an unknown person pardoned unjustly, it's unlikely that the New York prosecutor would pick this case up. I'm not saying I disagree with Andy about this. I can't remember where he comes down on this. I think he's right when he points out it's a political prosecution. I also think he's right when he says that the pardon of Trump, I mean, the pardon of Bannon was utterly and entirely indefensible, right? So, I mean, he's being consistent about this. He's not being partisan at all about this. But I guess where I come down about the fact that it's a politically motivated prosecution is I don't care. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I think it's worth acknowledging for the sake of honesty and for hygiene. And if Bannon weren't obviously guilty, or if the pardon were remotely defensible, I might be able to get worked up about it. But I guess to the extent I care at all, it's utterly and completely separated from any sympathy for Bannon himself. And I think this is the problem that a lot of people don't recognize about a lot of our politics, a lot of our debates about the presidency. When I say I don't recognize it, they don't recognize it in themselves. Procedural wrongs are bad, and we should do everything in our power within, you know, all good reason to avoid miscarriages of justice by getting the procedure wrong, right? So cops should read people their rights. There should be proper chains of evidence. Everyone has the right to the fair trial and to confront their accuser. All that stuff I believe in. But I think I've always had a problem with how our system rewarded the guilty for the failures of the system to go by the book. And I understand that as a pragmatic matter, there's a strong argument. I don't always agree with it, but there's a strong argument, a serious argument, that it's the least worst way to deal with such things, you know? So saying, oh, we should, like with Miranda warnings, right? I believe the Miranda warning thing is a perfectly good judicial invention, which just basically says, if you've watched a single cop show your entire life, you know this. Cops are supposed to say, you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to counsel. Any words you say will be used against you in a court, may be used against you in a court of law, yada, 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 right? But if you're like a serious, if you just come off a, you know, a three-state killing spree, or you've raped a bunch of people, the idea that if the cops didn't read you your rights, you should go, which I know it happens less than Hollywood portrays it. There are ways to, you know, remedy some of these things. But as a principle to illustrate my point, you know, the idea that somehow because the police screwed up procedure, the criminal should be free to go, I've always had problems with. And that's not to say I think cops should be able to screw up the procedure, but like it sometimes seems so alien to people, particularly of the defense lawyer bent, to say, well, why don't we dock the cop's pay, right? Why don't we suspend him for 2 weeks? Why should a rapist or a murderer benefit from a rookie cop's screw up? And you know, there are counter arguments to it about how, like, the way the systems and the bureaucracy works is that you would not actually have, like, this is the only way to put a real pain point and price on doing the procedure right. I get all that. I don't want to have that argument. It's been a long time since I read up on all that argument. But my point is that you can get angry about the corruption of the process, but that doesn't necessarily mean the individuals who are complaining about the process, even if they're complaining correctly, deserve any serious moral sympathy. So yeah, I am sure Bannon is pissed off, right? Because he was never actually indicted. There's no double jeopardy here, right? He can't actually claim that he was already tried for this crime, so he can't be tried again. Presidential pardons do not apply to state criminal law. But he definitely feels, I'm just projecting here, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. He definitely feels like he got screwed, because like he feels like he got away with the crime of the bilking of money, but also he got away with the crime of getting the pardon. And he probably thought he was free and clear. And he thinks that this is unfair. Now, in this case, let's just stipulate that it's unfair. Like Andy's right, it's a political prosecution, but for Bannon's political status, this wouldn't be happening. Let's just assume that's right. That's a serious criticism of our system. It is in no way an exoneration or a mitigation of Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon did what he did. He showed no remorse for it. He worked the system to get a grotesque pardon for it. And then he thought he could just go on about his grifting ways. Like the fact that this is in some, from some angle, either hypothetically or really, or in real terms, a dubious prosecution, in no way should change your opinion about Steve Bannon, the man. Steve Bannon is a carbuncle on American politics. And there's no defending him on the merits. And so like, yeah, the lawyerly pounding on the table, but this process is wrong or unfair, blah, 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 is kind of beside the point. And this sort of gets like my thing about, which I know I've written and talked a zillion times about why I hate the way we talk about impeachment stuff. And why I hate the way we talk about, is the president above the law or below the law? And like, if the only standard for judgment of presidents or public figures of any kind is whether or not they broke the law, then you're really saying we basically have no standards at all, except the absolute minimal standards for public conduct. And take this Mar-a-Lago stuff. I think I got a pretty good handle on it. I've listened to the advisory opinion stuff, and we had a good Dispatch podcast with Sarah running through it all again. I've done a lot of reading on it and all this. And I get the different kind of arguments and all that about the process. And I personally think the DOJ is correct to appeal this decision by Cannon, but that's fine. Whatever. My only point is that however the legal dust eventually settles on all of this, and whether or not Trump broke this law or that law or committed perjury or not, or with the obstruction of justice or not, and yada, yada, yada. Again, if you made a movie, if you just sort of described this in the abstract without invoking, you know, the names that ping your sense of hatred or loyalty, it's just obvious that Trump behaved horribly and demonstrated once again that he was never fit for office. And I don't really care in some grander sense about whether or not it was a class A felony or against the law about this or legal about that. That sort of doesn't matter to me. I mean, like how many people in your work life do you say, well, he didn't break the law, so we shouldn't fire him, right? Or he didn't break the law, so let's give him a promotion. Or he hasn't stolen anything from the storeroom, so the fact that he doesn't do his job very well doesn't matter, right? Or the fact that he's crude and he distracts people all the time from their work and he tells inappropriate jokes, but, you know, none of it is against the law, blah, blah, blah. That's not how we judge anything else, anybody else in our lives. You don't come up with the list of people that you want to invite to your party or your wedding, you know, or your kid's birthday or whatever, and say, okay, let's make a list. Let's make a list of the lawbreakers and the non-lawbreakers. And it's only when we get into these stupid political controversies where, in part because the lawyers invade TV and make it sound all very serious and stuff, does the argument switch from right and wrong to can or can't? And I just find that whole thing so demoralizing and indefensible in any grand scheme of things. And I, so like with the Trump stuff, like, I think it's pretty clear that, I mean, it depends which explanation he's offered, because he's offered so many, but for most of the explanations that he's offered, even the ones that contradict each other, I personally think if they were true, they would be worse than breaking the laws that he's accused of breaking. If he thought that, like, it was fine to make all of these classified documents and government documents that did not belong to him, quote unquote, declassified, which means, you know, that they are open to FOIA requests and all sorts of things, right? If he thought that, like, that doing that for his own convenience, or that so that he could have them lying around, at Mar-a-Lago, so he could show off to people, even if that was perfectly legal, that just shows you what an irresponsible buffoon he is. You know, I feel that same way about, like, the impeachment, both impeachments. You know, I felt that way about Bill Clinton. I wrote at length about all of this 25 years ago about Bill Clinton. It's like, I didn't really care about what laws Bill Clinton broke. I mean, that made it worse. But I thought Bill Clinton's behavior was what was impeachable. And I was very reluctant about impeaching Clinton at the time. I was for censure until things moved along. But once it got to the point where it was an impeachment thing, I certainly think the impeachment was utterly defensible. Like, I'm sure I've talked about this before. There was this great episode. I wrote about it in this piece called, I think, Greta Van Offel. There was this great episode of, I think it was Larry King, where Greta Van Susteren and Robert Bork were on TV. And people forget this now, because Greta Van Susteren is such a pliable such a pliable partisan. Like, once it became in her interest to be sort of Trumpy, and she became Trumpy. But when I was coming up in the 90s, she was a crazy left winger and liberal. And anyway, she was a huge Clinton defender. And I remember, so Judge Bork was on, and he was saying, basically making my point, right? Basically saying, look, it doesn't, you know, he was like, it doesn't really matter what the law is on this. This behavior in and of itself is so inappropriate that it's impeachable. And he was saying, like, look, if there was, and I'm paraphrasing because it's been a long time since I looked at this, but he said, you know, look, if a judge was having an open affair with one of his clerks in the office and doing the things that Clinton was doing with Lewinsky in the office, that would be impeachable. And I remember Greta Van Susteren just completely not getting it and saying, wait a sec, but they're both consenting adults? And Judge Bork was like, yeah. He says, but it's consensual? And he's like, yes. And like, this idea that you can impose penalties on our highest officials for their conduct, even if it's legal conduct, is bizarrely alien to a lot of people. And I get that one way you're supposed to do that is with elections, and that's the way we do it 99% of the time. But sometimes there's other conduct that is so reprehensible that it requires action before the next election, whether it's censure, whether it's impeachment, whether it's just simple, you know, informal condemnation. And the way in which partisans on both sides fall back onto this legalistic, amoral, instrumentalist horseshit. I'm sorry, I'm cursing a lot today. It's that kind of day. You guys are Ryan's free to bleep me as he sees fit. Just don't make it too loud, because I got some complaints the last time I cursed here. The bleeps hurt people's ears. Anyway, you get the point. Where else to go? Oh, so we talked about this. At my insistence, we talked about this a little bit on the Dispatch podcast. And I do think I think I might write about this today. I don't know. The White House claiming that they were on the side of opening schools against Republican intransigence. I mean, it takes something really egregious to get me to rush to Donald Trump's defense. I think I've demonstrated that so far this episode of The Remnant, but that is such unbelievable garbage. You know, Donald Trump, whether you want to say it's to his credit or not, whether you want to say it was based grounded on policy or not, he was on the right side of this debate. He was like insisting that the schools be opened. And of course, the presidents can't tell local schools whether to open or not. But he was like, let's open the schools. And Democrats, largely, though not entirely, because they were enthralled to the teachers' unions, who behaved utterly dishonorably throughout most of the pandemic, were against opening schools, even though they allocated gazillions of dollars to say that it was to open schools. And so we kept schools closed longer than pretty much any other comparable country. We've had massive learning loss, and there's just something about the liberal mindset that I don't want to speak too broadly, but I've written a lot about this, so I have very strong views about this. There's something about inherent in the sort of the progressive mind, or a certain form of the progressive mind, that can't really reconcile the idea that their side might have been the bad side, you know, to use sort of simplistic terms. You know, this is one of the points of I made in liberal fascism, was that when you read the standard liberal historians about, with a few exceptions, you know, like Alan Brinkley, I think, was a great historian, and Eric Goldman was a great historian. I mean, they're good liberal historians out there. I'm not trying to be too broad a brush, but when you read the sort of standard liberal narrative about American history, particularly 20th century American history, you get this weird dynamic where either the evil in America was due to conservatism, McCarthyism, you know, Reaganism, right-wing racism, isolationism, whatever, or it was a product of the evils of America itself, right? That this proves that America at its core is racist, or America at its core is inegalitarian, or sexist, or what, or homophobic, or whatever. And you never find in any of these indictments any sort of, again, I don't want to be categorical about this. In the indictments I am thinking about, you never hear people say, you know, conservatives really had nothing to do with this. And really, this wasn't an American problem. This was really that just the left screwed up, or that progressives screwed up, or that progressives were wrong and conservatives were right. There is this sort of no true Scotsman thing that goes on in the history of American progressivism that drives me crazy, which is one of the reasons why in my writing I harp so much on the progressive era. Yeah, there were people that you could, and like, political categories are complicated going back that far. And there are people that you could call conservatives, but they weren't conservatives in the mold of the, you know, the sort of modern conservative movement, the post-World War II, Buckley, Hayek, the conservative movement that George Nash describes, or even the conservative movement that Continetti describes for the most part you know, and I had that disagreement with Matt. I love Matt's book on the right, but I had problems with him starting in 1920 because I think that the pre-World War II right is so inchoate and non-ideological in terms that translate to the modern era that you kind of distort more than you reveal by putting the rise of the conservative movement in the 1920s. And to, in fairness to Conetti, and we've had this conversation a million times. Again, I love the book. He's a great guy, yada, yada, yada. He calls his book The Right. And he makes the point that there are competing factions on the right for how to define conservatism. So there's some capaciousness in Matt's schema as well. But if you read the reason I should back up, I'm in danger of self-indulging in very, very niche conservative eggheadery here. The reason why I make this distinction is that William F. Buckley turned his back on a lot of the kind of stuff that people would call conservative in the progressive era. And I'm not going to get into all that. Maybe I'll do a whole podcast on it or something like that. I didn't mean to tease you. Ryan, you can cut it if you think it's just really annoying. Let me get back to the point I was trying to make. And if I can only remember what it was. So that's right. So like there's this sort of no true Scotsman kind of thing that goes on with a lot of progressives where progressivism is just always right. Right. That like, and I mean this in almost like a sort of, I don't know if I mean it in an epistemological sense or a tautological sense, but in the sense that being progressive is synonymous with being right. It's sort of like saying the correct person is the one who is correct. The left has believed for a very long time that as a monopoly on political virtue, that its motivations are noble, so that whenever something goes wrong, it sort of goes back to this thing where this benefit of the doubt thing that I was talking about earlier. If something goes wrong, it's either because progressives weren't in charge, progressives got hijacked, or progressives stopped being progressive. But the idea that you could be both progressive and the villain is the kind of thing that makes, you know, Harvey Mudd's android friends heads explode. And I've written a ton about this, and you can go back. Maybe I will write about this today, so I won't waste it all here. But like, there have been plenty of times in American history where the left were the bad guys, you know. And I'm not saying that means that like all their ideas were illegitimate or yada yada. I'm just saying that if you're going to score the points about things that we can all agree were bad, it was the liberals who did it. I mean, it was FDR who put Japanese people in concentration camps. I mean, they weren't death camps or anything, but that was bad, right? FDR, when he was the assistant secretary of the Navy, ran this really terrible sting operation that ruined the lives of all these gay guys in the Navy. FDR used a lot of tactics that were later denounced by, you know, the left when they were used against communists. But you should read like Leo Rebuffo on the Brown Scare. I mean, it's interesting stuff, and I'm not exactly defending the quote unquote Browns in American politics, but you know, Upton Sinclair knew that Sacco and Vanzetti were guilty and decided to write that they were innocent anyway to stay popular with his fans. The Rosenbergs were guilty. You know, I mean, one of the reasons why the Hiss Chambers stuff became so, you know, world historic in the 1950s was that establishment sort of liberals just could not accept the idea that one of their own, this, you know, this sort of patrician elite liberal of good standing, was the bad guy. And he was a bad guy. Hiss was a bad guy. And I don't care how many classes at Bryn Mawr you took saying otherwise. He was the bad guy. The Rosenbergs were bad guys. You could argue maybe they didn't deserve the death penalty. I mean, I people make good faith arguments about the death penalty all the time, and that's sort of a different thing. But they were the bad guys. The people who sided with the communists in the 1930s and 40s, you know, some of them may have been dupes. That's fine. I think a lot of them were dupes. You know, Lenin never actually said, or at least there's no record that Lenin actually said, that Western intellectuals were useful idiots. But it, you know, it stuck around because it captured something real. You know, the Tuskegee experiment was complicated. And it does say something, obviously, it does indict something fundamental about America. But conservatives were nowhere near that thing. And certainly the conservatives of my ilk, which, look, I mean, this podcast is called The Remnant, so take that for what you will. But the conservatives of my ilk, limited government, free markets, all that kind of stuff, have almost no overlap with the quote-unquote conservatives of the progressive movement. And even the liberals of the progressive movement, vast numbers of them were racists and eugenicists, sympathetic to fascism, certainly sympathetic to communism. You know, the one holdout in Buck v. Bell on the Supreme Court, written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, the titan of liberal jurisprudence and a committed eugenicist and pretty much a jerk, was, I can't remember his name right now. It's escaped me. I think it was Butler. But was a Catholic conservative. Buck v. Bell, which said, which is the famous case that allowed for forced sterilization of the unfit, quote unquote unfit, was 8-1. And, you know, conservatives had nothing to do with that. You know, in lots of places, you know, like I understand that people want to retcon, and I'm not trying to do like the sort of Dinesh thing, that the real racists are all Democrats and the Republicans are all the good guys and all that kind of thing. But like FDR had racists and Klansmen in his coalition for years, and he made accommodations to them. He made apologies for them. One of Bill Clinton's mentors, William Fulbright of the Fulbright Scholarship fame, was a jackass isolationist on foreign policy, and he was a segregationist for a good long time. And again, I'm not trying to say the right were always right and the right are always the good guys or any of that kind of stuff. I've given up. I never really believed those kinds of arguments, but like I've given up even making any nod to those kinds of arguments. But there is this thing that I think is really unhealthy for our politics and our country, which says my side is never wrong. And the problem with that isn't just that that's historically inaccurate. It's that if you spend all of your time searching the horizon where the camps of your enemy reside, and for the threats to democracy, the threats to decency, the threats to Western civilization, whatever you want to call it, if you're only looking for those things to come out of the enemy camp, you're going to be completely blind to any similar threats coming out from behind you. And this is one of the reasons why I believe more and more in, like, I just did this podcast with Sam Harris. It should be out, I think, next week. It was interesting. You know, he wanted to do a lot of Trump bashing, which I'm, you know, his podcast, he asked me questions. I answered them and I bashed Trump a lot and I'm fine doing that. But he's sort of a guy of the left. And he takes seriously policing people on the left. And I'm a guy of the right, and I take seriously policing jackassery on the right. And I kind of feel like that is the most indispensable thing. People ask me, why do you spend so much time writing about the problems of the right and not about the left? Well, part of it is because I've written a lot about the left. But part of it is that I care more about the right. And I honestly and truly and sincerely and passionately believe this country is screwed if conservatism ceases to be about conserving what is best in America, about conserving the Constitution, about conserving and preserving liberty, about defining, about talking about this country as if it's a good country. This is part of the difference between my spiel about nationalism versus patriotism is, like, nationalism gives you lots of room to talk about how bad the country is or how mistreated we are. And patriotism is just much more open-hearted about this kind of stuff. This is a good and decent country. And if conservatives aren't going to be defending it and its traditions and its institutions, then no one is, because the left gets to be the left. And the populist right, which wants to be revolutionary and transformative and radical and all that kind of stuff and all that Sorab nonsense, it's like a contest between right-wing populists and left-wing populists is a contest over who can denigrate more of America. And I think that is just so unbelievably dangerous and unhealthy for conservatism, because conservatism, it drew straws, and it drew the straw saying, you're the guys who have to defend some unpopular stuff, like the Constitution, like free markets, like the rule of law, free trade, yada, yada, yada. And I'm okay. I'm not saying that if you're not for free trade, you're not a conservative anymore. I'll just say you're wrong. And I'm not saying that isn't room for this, tweak or that tweak to policy. But at the more fundamental level, it's like this country is supposed to have a party of change and a party of conservation. And if if what we call conservatism is no longer about conservation, but about radicalism, about tearing down, about, what Steve Bannon is totally honest when he says he's a Leninist. He says he's a radical who wants to tear down our institutions. Those guys at Compact, which I blissfully have not read since the first issue and haven't felt the need to, but those guys at Compact, they said in their mission statement, that they're radicals and that, and radical means to tear things down to the roots and start over. I don't want to tear America down to the roots and start over. I like this country, and I like the Democrats, a lot of them. I disagree with a lot of them, but I like Americans. And this is one of the things, if you've traveled abroad and you run into, or if you've lived abroad and you run into Americans, it feels good, even if you disagree with them about friggin' politics. It's to me, it's much more you're a Red Sox fan. You're wrong about that, but yeah, let's get coffee or whatever. And but when this whole argument about how politics is mapping like a religion. I think that's particularly dangerous when you have a religion that is not tolerant of other religions. And I think the sort of that religious mindset is taking over in lots of places. I think it has been prominent on the left for a very long time. I mean, a very long time, this mindset that we have a monopoly on moral virtue and politics, that we have that we've been right on every important question and conservatives have always been playing catch up. That, I think, is in the groundwater in universities and in high schools and in grade schools and mainstream media and all that. I think they believe that for a long time. And I think it's one of the reasons why conservatives have this sort of permanent chip on their shoulder these days, where they always are talking about how they're treated unfairly, throughout all of time. And the truth is that conservatives haven't always been treated unfairly. Sometimes they deserve the lumps they got. And the truth is, sometimes progressives have been the bad guys, have been wrong, And it was the conservatives who stopped them from proceeding with their wrongness even further. You know, a car needs a gas pedal and a brake pedal. And I'm fine being in the party, or forget party. I'm fine at being in the brake pedal team brake pedal. All right. I think I've gone long enough. Hour and 6 minutes. One thing, and I just bring this up because I think it's like super friggin' cool. And we kept meaning to talk more about Ukraine on the Dispatch podcast, and it didn't come up. You might have missed it, but the Ukrainians have commissioned all these artisans construction firms in Ukraine to build fake HIMARS systems. HIMARS are these incredibly impressive like rocket artillery things that have scared the dickens out of the Russians, where they can because they can go hundreds of miles, and they can take out command and control and supply line things and take out major pieces of material. And and so the HIMARS are actually causing the Russians to redeploy strategically to avoid their range and avoid being struck by them and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the Ukrainians have been building fake HIMARS installations and deploying them around. This is like, I don't know if it's balsa wood or oak or whatever, but it's wood, you know, it's like wood and paint. And the Russians are so scared of these things, they either move in response to a decoy, a dummy HIMARS system, or they drop incredibly expensive like cruise missiles on them to blow up stuff to turn it into sawdust. And it's got a very sort of D-Day kind of vibe kind of thing. And I just think it's like really awesome. Other than that, just some light housekeeping stuff. You know, we sent out on the Morning Dispatch a couple days ago this thing talking about the Naples conference after the election. And all of a sudden we got like a lot of interesting response. New people want to be speakers. A bunch of people want to have booths and that kind of thing. And we're not sure about booths and that kind of thing, but if you want to have a conversation with us, you know, drop us a line. Some people asked us about sponsorships. That is something that we're certainly interested in talking to people about. We're kind of, I'll just be honest about it. We're kind of stuck up and picky about sponsorships. Like there will not be the Jonah Goldberg cigar smoker sponsored by MyPillow, if you get my meaning. But if you're a mainstream, you know, organization or product, and you'd like to do some talk to us about some sponsorship opportunities for this conference, you know, again, drop us a line. My email is jonah@thedispatch.com. Steve is steve@thedispatch.com. Happy to talk to you. What else? Can't tell you how happy we are about Ala Pundit joining our ranks, and how happy we are about some other developments that we'll be announcing in due course. And so next week we're doing an all dispatch kind of retreat thing. It's very exciting. We're really looking forward to it. I don't know what they're going to do with the Morning Dispatch. Podcast schedules might be light or weird. And I may miss a G file or two. I just wanted to let you know in advance, because we're all sort of going to ground. But we won't go completely dark or anything like that. Again, I got to tell you, you know, thank you guys so much for your support. Things are really starting to fire on all cylinders for us. You know, the website has great content every single day. Subscriptions, both for the free and the paid stuff, are really trending in a great direction, by which I mean upwards at a nice rate of ascent. You know, I can get a little distracted by the comment section from time to time, even though I don't always comment. I do find that there are people who vex me, but you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. And other than that, really just I want to thank everybody for their support and their consideration, and I'll see you next time.